Last Sunday, we began a new sermon series, and we've called this, as you see on the screens, a picture-perfect Christmas. And last week, as Ryan began, we looked at the shepherds, and specifically the image we looked at last week was the shepherd's crook. And so, not to be outdone by last week, when some of you may not have been here, this Sunday we're looking at the gift of the Magi, as Bob prayed. And so, as we know, that they brought gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And so, to kind of help you maybe hopefully remember this message today, I'm going to ask a couple of people to come around, and we've got a little goodie for you today as well. We're going to give you some chocolate gold coins to help you remember the gift that the Magi brought. So take one of those. Feel free to go ahead and unwrap it. Eat it right now. That's certainly fine. I won't be jealous because I don't have one. You know, when we think of a picture-perfect Christmas, oftentimes we think of the nativity scene, right? We think of the picture of the Christ child and Mary and Joseph and the wise men and the shepherds all hovering around in some wooden structure where they're all celebrating. And I just noticed this. It looks like there's a cross in the back of this stable. Beautiful picture. And we think about that. Now, in a more modern context, when we think of a picture-perfect Christmas, we probably come closer to thinking something like this Norman Rockwell painting that we're probably all familiar with. In fact, I think many times when we think of picture-perfect holidays, that's what we're going for, right? Everybody sitting around the table, mom or grandma holding that big turkey and bringing out enough food, and it's going to be tasty and delicious. And everything is just perfect. All the kids are well-behaved. There's no fighting going on. Everything is picture-perfect. But I do have to tell you, marrying into the family that I did with Carrie, I married into a family with an expectation of this right here. The Norman Rockwell picture-perfect experience of the holidays, especially Christmas. I can, and you guys know, you know me well enough by now to know that I don't probably fit in that mold very well. You can laugh, it's okay, it's true. It's very true. I can remember holidays spending with Carrie's family, and her mom would be working so diligently to put together this incredible feast and have the perfect, you know, holiday dishes laid out on the table. And typically when that happens, you never eat at the right time. I mean, I'm an 11 o'clock lunch kind of guy, okay? I mean, look at me. I'd waste away if I had to wait till 12:30 or 1. And so it would get later in the day, and I can remember I'd walk through the kitchen, and I wouldn't fix myself a plate or anything, okay? But I'd just maybe pick up a piece of turkey off the plate and just kind of casually walk off. It was those kind of things that would drive my mother-in-law absolutely bonkers. It'd drive her crazy to the point of emotion because she wanted this picture-perfect Christmas. Fortunately for all of us, she's not that way anymore. I don't think she listens to the podcast, so I should be safe telling that story. I may have to edit that out. But we think about picture-perfect, and we have pictures like this, and you can go back to that picture of the nativity. And we think this is what Christmas must have been about. This is what everything was about. This is everything was ideal. Everything went perfectly. There was no hiccups or no issues at all. But is that really how Christmas really was? Is that really how that first Christmas really came about? I mean, let's think about this for a second, okay? Now, ladies, I want you to put yourself in Mary's shoes or sandals for just a moment. This woman is 8 or 9 months pregnant, and she's told that she has to travel 90 miles to Bethlehem for this census. 90 miles. Now, a good, healthy individual can travel walking about 20 miles a day, they say. So you're looking at a minimum of, what, 5 days to get there. But here we have Mary, who's pregnant, 8, 9 months pregnant. So this is going to be a happy journey, you can already tell, right? So to help her get there, to make the journey, quote, easier, we're going to put her on an animal maybe, like a donkey. In the first service, Amy Becker was sitting here, and I said, if I'd have been thinking, I'd have found a donkey and had her ride across it up the front and then tell us firsthand what that experience was like. You know, I thought it'd be great to get that input. You know, hey, so what'd you think, Amy? How smooth and easy was that? And yet this is what Mary went through. They go to Bethlehem, which if you remember was Joseph's ancestral home. I mean, that's where he would have had some relatives there. And not a single relative has space for him. Which is kind of funny, right? Here's a woman that's pregnant. You think somebody could have made some space, but no, no room. There's no hotels, no inns, no nothing. And so they're forced to find shelter wherever they can, and they find a stable. Now, it's not traditionally like we think of this stable here. In fact, it was probably more like a cave cut out in rock. And yes, it was a place where animals hung out. And animals did lots of things in there, if you get what I'm saying. It's certainly the place, ladies, that you want to have your baby. I mean, go ahead and just take in a big breath real quick, a big sniff of what you think this cave potentially smelled like, okay? Not pleasant, right? And yet here she is, the time has come that she has to give birth, and she's in this nasty, disgusting, musty, smelly cave, and that's where she has to deliver. We see pictures like this or others like this. Look at those sheep so nicely laying in the background. And I'm sure that's exactly how it happened because animals always do exactly what you want them to do at all times. Right? Of course not. The animals were probably having a field day, jumping and moving around. There was nothing peaceful. And then, to top it all off, what every woman wants is when you've given birth, to have strangers come visit you. People you don't know. These guys were low people in society. They were grungy, nasty, filthy. They probably spent more time with sheep than they did with humans. So that tells you a little bit about their personality. And after she gives birth, this is who comes and sees her. I mean, you can see this, right? She's just like, oh, thank you for coming. No, she's like, I'm tired. Get out. Okay? So why do I... And just... Ladies, I've had you think about all this, but gentlemen, just to bring you in on this, how many of you would like to propose this trip to your wife? Oh, amazing. No hands are going up. We have this mental, we have this picture, this perfect picture of what we think the nativity was like. Look at that. Mary, the light shining down from heaven. Isn't that just almost picture perfect? But it didn't happen that way. In fact, if we were truer to the events of that evening, we would have probably called this sermon series a not-so-picture-perfect Christmas. Today, I want us to pick up this not-so-picture-perfect Christmas and look at another aspect of it. Last week, we looked at the shepherds. We talked about their lowliness and the humility and who the announcement came to. It was not the top of society, but it was the lowly shepherds in the field. Today I want to look a little differently, though, and we're going to look at a very familiar story. It's in Matthew chapter 2. If you have your Bibles, you can turn there. It'll also be on the screen for you if you want to read up there as well. But I want us to look at Matthew's account to see another part of this picture that we normally equate with this picture-perfect Christmas and see how it kind of plugs in and what we can learn from this aspect as well. So Matthew chapter 2, we're going to start reading at verse 1. Through verse 12, it says this, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all of Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. In Bethlehem in Judea, they replied, for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people, Israel. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so I too may go and worship him. And they had heard after they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. Now, very familiar part of the story for most of us. In fact, I'd say that most of you probably have a nativity scene in your home. that depicts part of this story, right, where you have three wise men that are standing up there and coming to the nativity to present their gifts. But what I'd like to do first before we dig into what I really think is the meat of this passage is I'd like to take a moment to correct what I think is improper or incorrect Christmas theology. Sometimes I think we get our Christmas theology from our Christmas carols as opposed to our Bible. And so I'd really like to take a moment and go from a biblical perspective to understand a little bit different about this story. Now, this is not in an effort to destroy your Christmas, but it may mess up your nativity scene at home. I'm just warning you. Okay? First, I want you to understand this, okay? That when this scene takes place, Jesus is not a baby. In fact, if you notice, when we started reading, it talks about seeing the child Christ. The reason that is because Jesus was probably nearing the age of 2 when this took place. So in this picture right here, to be a little bit more accurate, if Jesus was in that manger, picture his little legs hanging off. Because he's not going to fit in that thing any longer. Because he's almost 2. Okay, because it took, the star may have arrived. And here's why he was 2. They traveled a great distance. It took them a while to get there. I don't think it took them 2 years. But more likely, Jesus had grown up. He was walking around and running around like toddlers do. But fortunately for Mary, I'm sure she didn't have to deal with the terrible 2s like we do, which would have been murder on Jesus' siblings when they were born. Can't you imagine this? Why are you acting this way? Jesus never acted this way. Man, no wonder his siblings did not like him as he grew up. So Jesus was older than we have in these pictures that we think about the wise men. Secondly, they're not here anymore. Did you catch where the wise men showed up? It didn't say in a cave or at a stable. It was at a house. They weren't in a stable for 2 years. So we know that somehow, for some reason, Joseph and Mary and Jesus decided to stay in Bethlehem. And somehow, some way, Joseph, being a good provider, takes the initiative and goes and finds them more permanent residence while they're there. He finds them a house. I'm sure it didn't have anything to do with Mary saying, if you don't get me out of this stable, I'm going to kill you. But that's not in Scripture either. I'm just speculating. So they're not in the stable. Jesus is about 2 years old. And here's the next thing. We sing a song occasionally. I'll be honest, we don't sing it here because I just think it's a bad song. We three kings. Okay, first off, there's not kings, okay? In history, if you study magi, you'll find out that these guys were really religious guys. They studied astronomy and astrology. They studied the stars. They were in the religious court, but they were not royalty themselves. About the 3rd century, I think, is when you begin to find that magi would be considered royalty. But here, at about in the 1st century BC AD kind of thing, right here around 0, that didn't take place. And so we know that they were not kings. They were serious students of astrology that had been developed into a very sophisticated science. And these guys were pros. They were leading figures in the religious court. But in by no means were they kings. Not only that, that song again, We Three Kings, we don't know how many of them there were. We know there were 3 gifts, but we don't know if there were 3 guys or 10 people or 20 people or whatever. But I will say, an understanding of the culture and an understanding of a trip of this magnitude tells us that there were probably more than 3. Now, why do I say that? Because these guys had to travel probably close to 900 miles, okay? It was going to take them, I believe it says, about 40 days to get there if they were consistently going boom, boom, boom to get there. Normally, when this kind of travel took place, you don't just set off on your own or with just a couple of you. There's going to be a large party traveling together. So there are more than 3, most likely. They weren't kings. Jesus is bigger. They're not at the stable. And so here's, you know, when you go home today and you see your nativity set, here's what I need you to do. Take the wise men, go put them in another room, because at the time of Jesus' birth, that's probably about how far they weigh from the actual scene, okay? Just kidding. You can keep your wise men. I'm just wanting to correct the misplaced theology sometimes. It's kind of fun, but this is truly what happened. This is what was taking place. So really, this is not a Christmas story. It's a 2 years later story. There's one other thing I'd like to talk about, and it's just simply this. When we read this story, sometimes we want to see, what is the star? What was that? What was that about? Do we know what that was? It's interesting as you study this passage to kind of see what was going on there, because there was an interesting alignment in outer space between Jupiter and Saturn that could have created some kind of interesting light coming from the heavens. So it's possible that that was happening and that would have been the star. Some people speculate that it could have possibly been a supernova or an exploding star that produced the light to guide them there. Some people like to say, oh no, it was Halley's Comet. Well, I'm going to tell you, Halley's Comet, I think, was around in 11 BC. If you study things, Jesus was probably born 6 to 4 BC, so it couldn't have been that one. Sorry, I know that messes some people up because they want that to be a neat little thing that happens, but it didn't. Finally, one other alternative is just simply this. It was supernatural. There was an angel. We already saw last week that when the birth of Jesus happened, the angels came and appeared to the shepherds and heralded his birth and told them where to go. It's very likely, in fact, in my opinion, I think that's more likely what happened, was there was a supernatural event that took place to guide these men, this group, to the Christ child. In fact, I think as we read this story, we find that the wise men show up in Jerusalem, and then there's something. We're not sure if the star disappeared for a time or comes back, but then once they begin their journey again after Jerusalem, they see the star again and continue to follow it. So there's got to be, to me, some kind of supernatural element taking place there. So all that said, that's the fun stuff, I think, in this passage to talk about, just to kind of maybe correct some Christmas theology there. But what do we see from this story? What is the spiritual message that we can take away from this? As I've read this story multiple times over the last couple of weeks, something really interesting stood out to me. I will say there are multiple messages that can be preached from this. In fact, you may have heard this preached. It's most likely that you have heard this preached in a Christmas series before. You know, you could easily talk about the Old Testament prophecy that's fulfilled in the Christ child, in his birth, and in the star, and in the wise men come. I mean, all that has significance, that there was a prophecy fulfilled in this story. So you could look at it that way. Another thing you could look at is you could look at it as a theme of God being in control, and that nothing that happens can thwart God's plan, that whatever God's plan, it will come to pass, regardless of how much man may try to stop and intervene. You can certainly get that from this passage, especially if you look at Matthew 2:16, and we see that Herod goes further to try to prevent Jesus from even living and tries to kill him, but God intervenes and that doesn't take place. You could even look at this passage and contrast the individuals of Herod and Jesus, both claiming to be kings, both in very close proximity to each other. In fact, Herod had built a palace called the Herodian about 3 miles from Bethlehem on the top of a hill. And here's Herod, this ruthless, brutal dictator who is known for his buildings and his architecture. And he's reigning with power and he's very forceful and he's very, you know, the kind of leader that most people would probably think of with that power behind them. And then you contrast that with Jesus, the Messiah, the king, born king of the Jews as well, but yet in much more lowly, humble setting. So you could contrast those two pictures as well. But to be honest, I didn't really want to talk about that, because as I read through this, what I saw was in Herod and in the wise men, I saw two contrasting responses to the birth of Jesus. Very interesting responses, and really both extreme responses. You see, as you read about Herod, as you begin to look at him and how he responds when the wise men show up, it's very easy to see that he was not happy about this event. In fact, the scripture tells us that he was disturbed. He was disturbed. This wasn't good news for him. In fact, it was so troubling to him that it says that the entire city of Jerusalem was disturbed with him. That kind of gives us an indication of what kind of leader he was, that he ruled with such might and fear that people were afraid that, oh my word, if Herod's upset, we're all upset because what is this crazy madman going to do? But Herod sees this event of Jesus' birth not as a good thing, and it worries him. He becomes very worried. But on the flip side, we see these wise men who come from almost 1,000 miles away. They travel, they come, they meet with Herod, they're looking for him, and they're out to find him regardless. And then when they do find the Christ child, when they get there, instead of being worried, we find a group of people that actually worship. They kneel down, they bow down, we're told. They pay homage to him. Their actions represent people who are acknowledging someone of a royal position, someone of a position greater than them. And then the gifts that they bring are also that way as well. Now, sometimes we like to read into the gifts and say the gold means this and the frankincense means this and the myrrh means this. I don't want us to get too drawn into that because the scripture does not lead us there necessarily. But what you need to understand about the gifts is that these were customary gifts that one person would give to royalty. The significance of the gifts is that it shows that these wise men, these magi, honestly believed that Christ was the king, that he was born king of the Jews. They traveled so far, they get there, and all they could do is worship him. And so we see between these two people right here a difference between worry and worship. What was there for Herod to worry about, though? What would make these wise men travel so far to see this Christ child? I think it's important to understand that in this time frame, that first century BC AD time frame, there was an expectation of a king to be born. And that many people believed that a something significant happening in space, in the heavenly realm, something would happen that would show that this had taken place. In fact, there's a Roman historian named Suetonius, and he wrote this. He says, throughout the whole of the East, there had spread an old and persistent belief. Destiny had decreed that at that time, men coming forth from Judah would seize power and rule the world. That's not from the Bible. That's from a Roman historian. There was this idea that someone was going to be born king, and that's why the Magi were looking, that's why they saw, and that's why they came. But that's also why Herod was worried and disturbed, because he knew, as an unscrupulous tyrant, a guy who claimed for himself the title King of the Jews, he knew that anyone else that claimed that title might be a threat, might be willing to come and overthrow him, and he is worried about that threat. And here we have the Magi showing up, and they come to Herod, and they tell him this: we're searching for the one born King of the Jews. What's interesting is what they said is because the wise men didn't say to him, we're looking for one who will become the king of the Jews or will one day be the king of the Jews. They're saying to Herod, we're looking for the one who is right now born king of the Jews. If there was ever a threat to Herod and his reign at this point, it was this. And Herod knew he had to do whatever he could. That worry overwhelmed him to the point of trying to take the problem out. So we see Herod has this worry, but these wise men worship, going a far distance, traveling almost 1,000 miles to find the one born King of the Jews. And what was their entire intent all along? They didn't leave their houses. They didn't leave their place of origin and then have to run by Walmart when they got there to say, oh, we didn't even bring anything. This is important. We need to bring them a gift. No, they left with the intent, with the purpose to worship the Christ child who'd been born King of the Jews. And they presented their gifts. The giving of the gifts was part of that worship. These weren't inexpensive gifts. In fact, to be honest, if you continue reading Matthew on, you see that Joseph receives a vision that says you have to flee because Herod's going to become crazy and try to kill all the kids. And it's probably these gifts that the wise men gave that financed the trip for Mary and Joseph. They're very valuable. It allowed them to live in Egypt for a long period of time before they could come back after Herod had passed away. They're expensive and they were helpful. But here we see first two very different responses. We see Herod full of worry, and we see the wise men full of worship. But there's one more thing I think that we can pull from this. We don't just see Herod worrying about Jesus, but we also see this worry begin to grow and develop, and it becomes even a different emotion, and I think it's the emotion of jealousy. He becomes very jealous of Jesus. He becomes jealous of the birth of the Christ, and he's not content to share his throne, his power with anyone. And these wise men have come and told him, Herod, essentially, you have a rival out there. And Herod thinks he's being shrewd and says, you know, let me know and I'll go worship him too. Fortunately, the Magi were given a vision to avoid Herod on their way home. And we read that they didn't go that way. It was a very risky move for them. They had to move quickly out of the area where Herod ruled in order to not be killed. And in response, Herod decides to kill all the baby boys 2 years old and younger. It's amazing to me what his jealousy causes him to do. If you read a little bit more about Herod, you understand that even this incredible event of killing babies was not enough to appease him. Because later in his life, as he was ill and he was suffering, that his paranoia was compounded. And we read that he turned to cruelty. And he had fits of rage. And when you look at the history of that time, you see that he killed his wife. He killed several of his close advisors and even killed at least two of his sons. He was a madman. But he wants what he doesn't have, and this jealousy consumes him. But what's interesting is as you see Herod's jealousy, on the flip side, we see the reaction of the Magi. These guys have traveled hundreds of miles. Not an easy journey, not a safe journey. And month after month, they go and they're seeking out the one who they believe to be a new king. And when they finally find him, did you see in chapter 2, verse 10, what their reaction was? It says, when they saw the star, they were overjoyed. I don't know how many of us would be that overjoyed, but they were overjoyed. In fact, deliriously happy. Maybe a slight overstatement, but it's close to how they felt when they saw the star. Even after traveling that far, getting to Jerusalem, they still weren't there. They had 6 more miles to go. They still were joyful at the prospects of seeing this new king. As I read this story over the last couple of weeks, I thought about this not so perfect, picture perfect scene that we associated with Christmas. And I ask you this question. What is your response to Jesus? How do you respond to the birth of Jesus? You see, what's interesting to me is that the wise men from afar, they see a star, and in that they see the divine fingerprints of God that cause them to move, to come, and with joy come to a place to worship Jesus. I wonder how many of us associate our journey with Jesus with joy. More likely, sometimes we look at it as drudgery. We look at it as obligation. And yet these men were able to go hundreds and hundreds of miles with joy just to worship the Christ child. I dare say some of us may have woke up this morning and thought about church and not had much joy. It happens. Not to the pastor, of course. We always love being here. But mile after mile, they followed this star, unwilling to stop until they got there, unwilling to give up until they realized all that was before them. How often do we find any joy, much less great joy, when we follow Jesus? You see, what I think this story highlights for me is just simply this. It shows the extreme reactions people that can have to Jesus. And what I think is in our culture, in our day and age, I think what we see is that casual commitments to Jesus are easy and unfortunately seem to be the culture and our norm. But when we truly understand who He is and who it is we're chasing after, when we understand who that star is leading us to, we will want to follow. We will want to be willing to sacrifice and give. We'll be willing to drop things in order to find time to worship Him. Can you imagine what would have happened to the wise men if they had stopped early? If they'd gotten to Jerusalem, which was said earlier was 6 miles away from Bethlehem, if they'd stopped right there, and in talking to Herod, he said, oh, it's going to happen over there. And they said, oh, okay, well, that's great. That's all we needed to know. What would they have missed out on had they stopped right there if they hadn't gone the 6 extra miles? Fortunately for them, they didn't stop. They continued the journey, and they realized and saw and worshiped the King. Now, I will caution here. I don't want to elevate these wise men. I don't think they had an understanding that He was the Messiah. I don't think they knew that He was God's Son. I think they looked at Him and just said, He's born a King. But what they didn't know was that their worship was much greater than they could have ever anticipated. What's interesting to me is that in this story, you see these wise men traveling this great distance. 6 miles away, you have Herod and these religious leaders. Do you notice when they get together and they start talking about this star, these religious leaders didn't go, we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen. We're not sure. They went exactly to the Old Testament prophecy. They knew in Numbers 24 when Balaam prophesied and talked about a star that would rise out of Judah. They knew the prophecy of Micah chapter 2 that talked about this birth. And yet, 6 miles away, right under their noses, they missed it. They completely missed it. They knew the prophecy. They knew that it pointed to the Messiah. And they know that, and they missed it. I think there's an interesting lesson for all of us here. And the question is, how will we respond to Jesus? How will we view Jesus? Because how we view Jesus will determine how we respond. You see, Herod had one view, and the Magi had another. Herod worried and was jealous, and the Magi worshiped with joy. How will we see Jesus? Will we see Jesus as Herod saw Jesus? Do we see Him as a danger? A danger to how we live, a danger to our lifestyle, a danger to what we want to do and our wishes and whims? Or will we see Him as a deliverer? Someone we need to set us free, to lead us from the bondage of slavery, of sin? Will we see Him as danger or deliverer? Will we see Him as an intimidator? Someone who's lording over us, who's not right, but telling us what we can and can't do? Or will we see Him as Emmanuel? God with us. Will we see Jesus as a risk that's not worth taking? Or will we see Him truly as our Redeemer? Will we see Jesus as a situation needing to be dealt with and pushed away? Or will we see Him as our Savior? You see, we have to ask, will we see Jesus as a menace to our existence? Or will we see Him as our Messiah, the promised one, come to save? That's the question we have to answer. How will you see Jesus? You see, the thing we have to understand about Jesus, and I've said this before, but I think it's a very important point, is that Jesus is not benign. You can't ignore it. You can't walk away from it. You can't just say, oh, that's Jesus. I'm going to put Him over here in the corner. Jesus demands a response. How will we respond? Can't just be this casual commitment, this casual, I'll pick it up when I want to and not when I don't. Because Jesus, if He's truly Jesus, demands more than that, demands a greater response. There may be some people here today that you're hearing this, and you, like the wise men, you see the divine fingerprints of God in things around you. You see things drawing you to. Maybe there's a star metaphorically in your life and it's drawing you towards Jesus. How will you respond today? Will you respond by worrying and pushing Him away, or will you respond by surrendering with joy and worship and surrendering to Him as your Lord and Savior? Sometimes we need to stop fighting and we just need to say yes to Jesus. For others of us, it may be a point where Jesus is calling us to a deeper commitment, to step out of a comfort zone, to make a big, bold statement, to do or serve somewhere that maybe you think scares you to death. Jesus is not benign. He demands an extreme response, to be honest. And I hate that word extreme. It gets so misused in our society. But when we talk about the extreme response of Jesus, what are we talking about? We're not talking about bashing people over the head with the Bible. We're talking about showing people extreme love and extreme grace and showing to them the same thing that Jesus has shown to us. How will you respond to the birth of Jesus?